Extension number 120333.
Reverend Gordon Wilson, Reel 3.
The week of prayer for world peace, at our first meeting at Westminster, the home of Canon Edward Carpenter, who later became the Dean of Westminster, we decided that it must be an interfaith initiative, no matter what else, even though we could foresee that some people would have misgivings about that. In fact, I remember Lord, the Scottish, gosh, I'm sorry, I'm afraid names don't come quickly to me. Dr. Paul.
Iona.
Yes.
Lord Iona. Yes, well, perhaps they can find that out at the museum.
Oh.
The name might come back to you, mightn't it?
Yes, it probably will, yes.
Yes. What was the point you were going to
Well,
make
the point is that he was one of our sponsors, and he's a very well-known figure. In fact, he's somebody that I very greatly admire. He became a pacifist during the 1914 war and was very much a soldier there, and then came to the conclusion that this was contrary to his understanding of the way of Jesus Christ, and became an adamant pacifist, and is the type of person who doesn't do things by halves. And so he began to found a pacifist movement in Scotland, in the Church of Scotland, and then founded the Iona community, with which his name has always been identified. And he sent me a letter to say that how could he pray to no man shall come to the Father except through me, said Jesus. How can he pray to the Father in the company of those who flouted that saying of Jesus? And therefore, in his adamant sort of way, he said, strike my name off your list. And I wrote back to him, and I, quite a long letter, in which I said that the thing that really worried me was not that some people of other faiths were involved in the peace movement. The thing that really upset me was the fact that Christians, who, in loyalty to Jesus Christ, ought to follow a way which, if you follow his teaching, would be pacifist, are not united about this attitude. You can't find unity in the Christian church about what our attitude to violence should be. And that worries me far more than the possibility of mingling with other faiths. And I must have been eloquent enough to have moved him a little bit. He said, well, so long as you're secretary of the Week of Prayer for World Peace, you can include me on the list, continue to include me.
Does it dishearten you that, you know, despite this wonderful movement that you've got and the people praying all over the world, something like the Gulf War happened?
Well, you know, if you look at my circular letter, you'll perhaps find the answer to that. The one that I did all over this country and the world.
Yeah, could you give me the gist of it on here, do you think? You know, what do you yourself think? You know, is it a great disappointment?
Well, it is naturally a disappointment, but I start by asking the question, does it signify a failure of our prayers for peace during the last 16 years since the week began? Does it make further prayers for peace futile? And I say, we all know that the answer to both questions is a resounding no. There's a greater need than ever for prayer for peace. And especially this year, after the Gulf crisis, we believe that it's more significant than ever. The fellowship of prayer, including many religious faiths, will seem more intense than ever, whatever the course of events since the 15th of January 1991. We pray together not merely for the cessation of conflict and for the victims of war, but for a new vision by all people of faith, the vision of a real alternative to violence as a means of resolving conflict. This power of violence, especially when applied with scientific precision, as in the Gulf War, seems to be deadly efficient in countering evil threats. In fact, it merely generates more evil. By contrast, the power of love seems merely feeble. The purpose of the Week of Prayer for World Peace is to generate what the Pope, when he visited Ireland, called the irresistible force, which comes from people, communities who stand together in their acceptance of Jesus' supreme message of love, based in peace and reconciliation and in their rejection of all violence, constitute an irresistible force to achieve what many regard as impossible and destined to remain so. That's what the Pope said at Drogheda when he went to Ireland. And that is very significant, is this irresistible force which comes from a commitment to the power of love, which is generated by prayer in fellowship together, even of different faiths. And when we can visualize the unity of the human family, regardless of our denominations or our differences, we can see ourselves as members of one human family, then we can begin to see what the possibilities are in that way. And that is the true purpose of God in all our faiths, which we are proclaiming all the time, I'm quite convinced. So, in a way, that is the answer to your question, do we feel that we've failed in our prayers? I think there's a greater need than ever to pray for an alternative to violence as a means of resolving conflict.
Because it's the politicians, isn't it, who make war. And, you know, it's a question, I suppose, of influencing...
Well, politicians can be influenced in ways that are not always on the agenda of a party programme. Like the thing that Colin Morris was asking for, a pacifist programme. Opinion changes in all kinds of unpredictable ways. Look at the way that there was a movement against capital punishment reflected in the decisions of Parliament. Parliament is influenced by subtle flows of opinion, which can't always be exactly categorised in straightforward terms. But when mankind reaches the point when it becomes aware that violence is no longer tolerable, it will find a way to an alternative. In the same way that mankind has discovered things like electricity and so on, when the time has come, the means have been found to give expression to this, and I believe the same will apply to the realization that violence is no longer tolerable. I think we were becoming aware of that in 1945 with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and since then we've become more and more aware of it, and I think now the events at the present moment and the plight of the Kurds are making us realize that we have to find a different way. It's not easy. I mean, they're desperately trying to do it. John Major's suggestion is ridiculed by some about a safe haven and so on. But he has given expression to a popular thought that somehow this is intolerable and it cannot be allowed to continue. We must find a way around it. And that is how I think opinion is changed. That is how I think Christianity can change opinion in the world in ways that you can't put into a political program so easily. And politicians are as susceptible to that influence as anybody else. They're the ones who, once public opinion has been given expression, will find the means of putting it into effect. That's the politician's job. In the Bible, there was always a tension between what the Israelites called the king and the prophet. The king was legislating for people as they were, and they couldn't start thinking of idealistic things, that this is how people ought to be. The prophet, on the other hand, was saying, this is how people ought to be. He was preaching an impossible ideal. It was for the prophet to influence the king in such a way that the king was able to put into effect what the prophet had visualized. We can see that particularly in people like Jeremiah and the kings of Israel. And I think the same kind of antithesis between the prophet on the one hand and the ruler on the other. There must always be tension between the two. If we followed the prophet all the time, we should get no kind of practical laws at all. But he is preaching an impossible ideal. He's expecting the impossible to happen. And the king or the ruler is saying, we can only go, the art of the possible is what people call politics. We can only do what is possible. And the prophet is saying, well, you must make this possible. I think that the words of the Pope in Ireland are setting a standard that others have got to follow. We know how very far we are from that standard by the way that the events have still continued to happen in Northern Ireland. But the Pope is the one who has the right to speak to many of the people there, and his words should be listened to, and we should put into effect that irresistible force that he's speaking about, which can't be quantified in political terms, but which is a reality in the world, if once it is an expression of real conviction on the people who are prepared to follow that way and accept the consequences. That is the point about Christianity. It is not merely preaching an ideal about loving your enemies and turning the other cheek and so on. It is preaching the ideal and saying you are prepared to accept the consequences of following that ideal, no matter where they may lead you. And that as a result of being totally faithful to that, we shall find ways opening that we can't predict at this moment. And that, I believe, is the way that things like Christianity and pacifism, I personally equate the two. I think that Jesus was a pacifist and that he preached a pacifist faith. And this is how they can influence the world even more effectively than the power of armaments, which are leading only to a dead end all the time. The phrase that comes into my mind comes from Aldous Huxley in Eyeless in Gaza, where he makes, I think it's Anthony Beevis, isn't it, the character, who is speaking at a peace meeting. And he says something that I've always thought was very, very pertinent. Evil is the accentuation of division. Well, Christianity is concerned with dealing with evil, and violence is the thing which divides, destroys, takes away life. Love is the thing which creates and unites. Evil is the accentuation of division, and love is the means of the only means of overcoming that evil. We're getting a little bit sort of philosophical here, but this is the basis upon which I found my attitude to political events today, even the current events of Iraq at the present time. It's too simplistic to think that you can bash evil on the head and smash it into the ground. That is what Stormy Norman, the American general, was thinking, and it was logical to him that he should have not stopped at the end of Kuwait, but have gone on and gone to Baghdad. In a way, simplistically, it may be true that he was right. It seems to us that would have been the true solution, and many people are now saying it. But even that probably would not have eradicated all the possibilities of evil occurring and breaking out again. So that there has to be a different way. And we are the people who have to give the voice to that different way. We've got to show mankind, have the vision to show mankind to go beyond the art of the possible, to accept the possibility of the impossible, which no politician could ever do, but which it is our task as prophets to be able to put before people in such a way that they find the means of making the impossible happen. That's how we can get a political program out of our ideals.
Your life story, you know, in World War II later, Reverend Wilson. But while we're on this very interesting theme, could I ask you what you yourself thought of the peace movement's activity during this Gulf crisis and then the war? You know, were you heartened or otherwise with the response of various peace groups, the marches, the demonstrations, the coverage in the media, this sort of thing?
Yes, I can't say that I was very strongly heartened by it. It was such a desperate situation. It seemed, with the plight of Kuwait and the intransigence of Saddam Hussein, that merely protesting was not going to be enough. It was something much deeper than that. But on the other hand, just to remain silent is not a very helpful thing to do. I think when people have a witness, they have to give expression to it, even in unfavourable situations. And in a sense, my response to it was perhaps a little bit ambivalent. I don't know, but I don't think there were easy responses to the situation, such as might have been suggested by some of the protests at the time, which can only deal in slogans and don't really get very deeply into the complexity of the situation. What I was, I don't know whether you want to go back now to the wartime situation. What I was, I had mentioned to you a little earlier, but I could perhaps make, this is the time when I could mention it. I was preparing for ordination, and I was working for the Norwich Union Insurance Company and taking Insurance Institute exams at the same time as I was studying to complete what I hadn't. In those days, we didn't have O-levels and A-levels. We had things like school certificate and higher certificate and matriculation. To get into university, you had to have matriculation. And for that, the school certificate had to provide 5 credits, as they called them. I had 3 credits. And therefore, I had to make up the 2 subjects in order to matriculate if I was going to go to university. And I studied English and history while I was studying Insurance Institute exams. I failed the Insurance Institute exams. I couldn't give a mind to the 2 things. But I did pass the English and history and found that very fascinating. And so I was qualified to go to Durham University. And in 1940, I'd been accepted as a student at St. John's College, Durham. And as soon as I got the results, I'd taken the exam in Manchester. During an air raid, incidentally, I'd travelled to Manchester from Sheffield, and while I was on the train, an air raid happened, and we had to go off into Sheldon and had to walk for quite a long way from a place called Guidebridge into the middle of Manchester. Anyway, that's irrelevant. I passed the examination and was offered a place at Durham. And as soon as I was offered it, I went to see my boss in the Norwich Union and gave him my notice, and I had a very awful feeling of pulling the rug from under my feet suddenly. I just did it like that and said, I'm going to go to college to be ordained. And they asked me if I would help them by keeping on until they were able to do something to get a replacement, and I agreed to do that, which meant that in those days we worked on Saturday mornings, which meant on the Saturday I was leaving, I went in to work and was there until 12 o'clock. And then at 12 o'clock, I left the office and took my suitcase and walked down to Sheffield Victoria Station and caught the train for Durham. And having been in the office until 12 or 10 past 12 on the Saturday morning, I was dining in college that evening. A big sudden transfer.
Could I please ask you, your job, how had they reacted to your pacifism, the tribunal and everything? Were they sympathetic towards you, the people you worked for?
In the office in Sheffield? Yes. Well, of course, we talked a lot together and they knew me. And some were more sympathetic than others. I mean, a number of them were being called up themselves to go off to Egypt, as the British forces seemed to go in those days. And the local secretary, who was the boss that I was talking about, used to argue with me in the way that sometimes raising the kind of points that you're raising, and we used to discuss this together. And a friendly kind of discussion. There was no antipathy. I wore my War We Say No badge all through those years. And a man once stopped me in the main street of Sheffield and said, aren't you afraid somebody will slap you across the face when they see that? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, just too bad if they do. But on the other hand, a tram conductor in Attercliffe, the very far east end of Sheffield, looked at the badge and said, that right lad, using the Yorkshire way of speaking. And generally speaking, people, that was the attitude of people. They didn't like to agree with what I was doing, didn't want to identify themselves with me, but on the other hand, they felt that I was standing for something that they would like to stand for themselves. So that prevailed in the office in a way. And
how about your family?
Well, my brother was called up. Well, no, he wasn't called up. He volunteered because he was didn't want to wait for his call. He wanted to go in the Navy. And he was then working as a clerk at the bank and went into the Navy. And he was on what they called a monitor, a ship with huge guns in the Mediterranean at the time of the landings at what was the name of the place on the west coast of Italy? I've forgotten the name now, just for the moment.
Anzio, would it be?
That's Anzio. Right, Anzio, yes. He was there, and while they were in those waters, he told me how he saw an American cruiser just blown out of the water. It was horrified him. And they hit a mine, and as a result of hitting the mine, he joined up under what they then called the Y scheme, which meant that if he went into the ranks, he could prepare for possible training as an officer. And it was because they hit a mine that he was able to go home and was discharged from the ship when the ship's company were disbanded, and became, in fact, an officer. Well, during that time in Italy, I remember him writing a letter to me saying that he hoped I would remain faithful to all that I was standing for and doing, being prepared for ordination and my conscience objection. He said, what we're doing, I can only see as entirely negative, and that when all this is over, there'll have to be somebody around who'll be showing us a different kind of way in which I hope you will remain faithful to what you're doing. And that letter meant a great deal to me, written from the height of battle, so to speak. So that, in a sense, sums up the attitude. My brother and I are very close together. He's coming over to England from New Zealand in next month. And I sometimes preach when I'm out in New Zealand. And the message that I preach is the one that he's always identified with me. And he introduces me to his friends out there, and some of whom were in the war. And New Zealand is a very unsympathetic place for conscientious objection. But the local newspapers have done interviews with me, and I've made my views quite clear and broadcast and so on. They've always felt that they were just as much friends, even though I am that sort of person that they wouldn't normally have thought of in that way. So that is the family's attitude. My father and mother didn't make any comment at all. I had an uncle who had been a conscientious objector during the 1914 war. He was a member of the Plymouth Brethren, and he was actually on a farm during that war. By now he'd become an old man, but I never lost any friends. In fact, a little incident, again, may or may not just be interesting to you. At this church, Holy Trinity in the Wicker, which was very much in the amongst the poorer part of Sheffield, we had a caretaker who was a rather large woman, and she had a little husband who used to do the coke boiler and so on. And we were quite matey, but when the war came, she turned against me. And I heard from other people that she talked of me as a yellow-livered little rat. Well, when this chap, Samuel Price, had been offered a living in London at St. James's Hatcham, the church was left without a vicar. And as a student, although I couldn't celebrate communion and so on, I was able to take all the services. And I looked after all the services of the church during the months when I was at home on vacation, and kept it going. And this caretaker lady was so loved her church that when I went back to college after the holidays, or the next term, she gave me a little paper bag with 2 half-crowns in it for me to take back with me to spend when I the next term, which 2 half-crowns was quite a lot of money to people in her situation, but is infinitesimal, really. Well, I thought that was a gesture that meant a very great deal, that this person that she'd regarded as in so contemptuously, she wanted to make this little gift to her, and going back to college, to show her appreciation for the way I take the services in the church. And that, I think, indicates the human situation. On the surface, some people are quite prepared to make that sort of remark, but when you are together as two human beings thinking about what you both regard as important, that sort of comment doesn't have any relevance at all. And I think that would have been true to my relations to people during the war, really. As I say, when I got to the point of being accepted for ordination, I went to see the Bishop of Sheffield, and we had a discussion about my situation, and which he didn't come out with his own views. He sort of, as I used to say, he wriggled about on the settee in an uncomfortable sort of way, but didn't come up with anything direct. And then the next day, I got a letter from him saying that I should realise that having contracted out of the obligations of my generation, I should have no influence with men. Which was a pretty devastating thing for a bishop to say to somebody about to become a curate in the church. Well, it didn't worry me, but in point of fact, I have found that I've had more influence with men than a lot of people in many ways. Been more influence on men than women in most ways. Some men who were involved in the war. I have had people walk out of church when there was a nuclear submarine in Birkenhead, and I went on a demonstration against the blessing of that by the bishop, and I preached about this in the church. Somebody at the back of the church got up and walked out very ostentatiously, but the rest of the congregation didn't think too much of that gesture, and they made it clear that they didn't. But I never had any, during the war, never had any antipathy from people. The attitude was fairly generally the attitude, well, I can't agree with what you're saying. I remember particularly a young man who was a railway porter in Sheffield, and I remember the railway porters going on strike for a rise in wages. Their wages were then £2 a week. And it wasn't, even in 1940, it wasn't a living wage. I can remember that particularly. They lived in a little sort of back-to-back house in Sheffield. He was a great friend. And when I went to college, and I was leaving the Fellowship of the Church and going off to Durham, not to the war, he had been called up. And he came to me and apologised to me because he had accepted his call-up. He apologised to me, conscientious objector, and he said, I can't go against my mates, because he was wearing his uniform. But he felt he should have done what I'd done, but he couldn't go against his mates. Well, I really respect that and understood it. So that is the kind of thing which gives an idea of the relationship. Somebody even apologising to a conscientious objector because it was wearing the uniform and not going against his mates, well, I think that's a very real thing. I think it's support of the mates, which is the most important thing of all, really. And he wrote to me from Italy as well. He'd met my brother Alan while I was out there, and Alan recalls how they met once in Taranto, the tour of Italy, while they were both engaged in the war at that time.
While we're on this theme, you know, of people in war being sympathetic to pacifist ideas, could you give me some more examples?
Another example of what I believe to be the error of the Bishop of Sheffield but I would have no influence with men, was the fact that in Crewe, when I was the vicar there, I used to preach on Remembrance Day about the problem of war and the remembrance of all the horrors of war, and used to give a fairly straight pacifist message on that occasion. Well, there was a man who worked for the railways. He was working in Rugby and had been moved back up to Crewe, and he had become involved with church life and wanted to find a church in Crewe where he could feel at home. And he came to our church and heard me preaching and felt that this was the kind of church he wanted to belong to. And so he joined the church and became, over the course of time, over some difficulties that we'd had and arguments in the parish, he became a very staunch friend and supporter. And we felt we had a very great deal in common. He respected my situation. I respected his situation. He had been in the airborne forces and had been in a glider